Welcome to the B-side. It is January of 2016. We're in a new year, and we're back. I'm joined, as always, by Pastor Steve Kroger.
Hello.
And, yes, he's very excited. And we have a special guest today joining us. Just moved. His wife just joined the staff, and he came in to drop something off for her yesterday, and we strong-armed him and forced him to come.
I don't think I could strong-arm JD.
I
think he could strong-arm.
Yeah, he could strong-arm. It would be a competition. There was no physical altercation, but JD DeClercq joining us, fresh off a move from Red Deer. Welcome, JD.
Thank you.
So we were excited to kind of relaunch into the podcast for 2016, and format's going to very much stay similar, but we want to be able to tackle questions as they come up. And so if you're not aware, you should be, but we've started a 1 year Bible reading program with the Bible Project this January to kind of read through the story of the scriptures chronologically between January and obviously the end of December. And I realized very quickly, just on my own doing some of the reading, that stuff's going to come up. There's going to be things where we're going to need clarity and understanding and maybe just kind of want to dig a bit more into. And so we thought that might be the primary way that we format the podcast from here on out, if it's deemed reasonable for people and they want to send in their questions that they come up with through the text, or other questions. Of course, we'll still tackle that stuff on issues, but we thought that would be how we do it, and we've kind of picked out a few things that stood out to us in our readings, and so what I'm going to do is kind of get out of the way and let JD and Steve kind of have a conversation about these things, because they're a lot smarter than I am. More or less, the questions, I'll be honest, the questions came from me today, because I, in my reading, found some things that I was like, I hadn't heard of that before. That's interesting, and so we're just going to kind of touch on three. The first one, we'll go chronologically, maybe, makes sense, most sense? Yeah. The first one that stood out to me was from Genesis 3, verse 22. And the reason it stood out to me, and I just naively had assumptions and I put too much stuff on the text, it's where the fall obviously happens, and toward the end of that chapter, God is pronouncing his judgment on Adam and on Eve, and banishing from the garden. And I'd always kind of had this assumption that they got kicked out of the garden because they were sinful, which is probably partly true. But there's this really key phrase that stood out to me that God said to them, starting in verse 22, he said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. Now, lest he reach out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever, therefore the Lord God sent him out of the garden to work the ground from which he was taken." I found that really peculiar. Is that... there's a reason to find that peculiar, this idea that if they had eaten from the tree of life, the curse of sin wouldn't apply to them in bodily death. It would allow them to live forever. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question I came up with as I was reading was that an act of judgment or an act of grace or a bit of both, in that there's going to be the decay of sin as a result of their lives, and so they eat from the tree of life, they live forever, but they still have sin, or am I just asking the wrong question?
It's simply an act of mercy that they don't live forever. The purpose of the tree of life is to sustain them for life as long as they eat of it.
Right.
So he's removing from them... when we're dealing with Genesis, there's a lot of mystery in that. There's a lot of questions that are raised by the text, and you get little statements, and you go, well, what does that mean? And I get a sense of what it means, but that raises questions for me that we don't have answers to. So I want to be careful, but the sense, I think, is that they would have lived forever by, not by being eternal beings, which they weren't.
Right.
They would have lived forever as finite beings who ate the fruit that sustained them for eternity. So they weren't by default eternal, but by eating of the tree of life, they would live forever as long as they ate it. And by God cutting off their access to the tree of life, he is putting a time limit on them, which is an act of mercy. They won't suffer under the curse of sin forever.
Hmm.
The other thing about, though, leaving the garden is that it's a shift from eating, like plucking fruit, eat of any tree in the garden, to actually the introduction of painful toil, because they go from the Lord God sent him out from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he was taken. So it's a shift not only in no longer access to the tree of life, but it's a shift from eating and tending the garden to the painful toil of the curse. So that makes their life more painful and difficult.
Yeah, I was, I think you're totally right there. It is a mercy that they won't live forever in this, in their fallen state. But it also seems to me like they are, like it's a reward to eat from the tree of life. That's, that is for those who are obedient. I'm thinking later in Revelation, which is God will take away their share in the tree of life. So, certainly, but they lose the benefits of the garden. Right? Yeah. All the other trees, they know they get kicked out. They can't eat any of the fruit of the all the good trees in the garden, and they're not allowed to eat of the tree of life.
And there's a sense of the presence of God.
Yeah.
Right. It's more intimate.
Which references that in Revelation, it talks about paradise,
where the tree is.
Where the tree is.
So the tree of life comes back in Revelation 2 and 22, where that's where people and it. You pointed out before, that's where the healing of the nations comes from, the leaves of the tree of life. So it's a tree of restoration and eternal life.
Yeah.
Whether we literally eat of it, everyone, in eternity, or it's more of a symbolic image. The other thing about the garden, of course, is that all the garden imagery comes back in the tabernacle and the temple, which the tabernacle and the temple are the presence of God in the midst of his people. And so this is what you get in the tabernacle and temple, like all these acacia trees and palm trees and garden type imagery in the temple to signify that this is like Garden of Eden.
That's right. Even so the lampstand is a tree
image. Yeah. The lampstand is a tree. So that the temple is a return to the garden. So the garden signifies the presence of the presence of God in a more profound and intimate way. So the garden, you have the eternal life because of the tree. You have, instead of painful toil, you have God's provision. And you have the presence of God in a more intimate way. And those are all removed. But restored in the end of Revelation.
Right. So it's not, I think the thing that for me that kind of opened my eyes was like, maybe, and this, I could be alone in this, it always just felt like very much the fall and the expulsion from the garden was an eviction. Like, it was like, here you've broken the tenets of our lease agreement, and you can no longer live here.
Yeah.
Which is partly true, but that there is layered in there this kind of graceful, merciful protection and kind of punishment at the same time. Like, I don't know if that's the right way to phrase it, but
the punishment is a mercy.
Right.
In the sense that the death means, one, they don't get to live forever, but two, they don't have to live forever.
Yeah.
In their broken, painful existence. Yeah. So it's both at the same time.
Yeah. That's right. It's interesting. Anyway, moving on. I thought that was one that stood out. One other thing that we were talking about recently that stood out is Lamech's words in Genesis chapter 5, so just before preceding the flood story, there's this kind of more or less this kind of lineage record of all the descendants, and toward the end in verse 29 of chapter 5 talks about the birth of Noah, and starting in verse 28 actually says, when Lamech had lived 182 years, he fathered a son and called him Noah. And then he said this about Noah. It says, saying, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. And the reason that stood out to me was Noah's the last living dude before the earth is flooded by God in the next chapters, in the following chapters. And here's his father, Lamech, which you guys helped me clarify in our pre-podcast meeting, is a different Lamech than from the descendant of Cain.
Yeah. Two Lamechs.
But is this a prophecy that he's putting on Noah? It sounds like it. It's obviously important enough for the writer of Genesis to mention. I don't know. What what do we do with a statement like this? What does it mean, or how is it fulfilled, or is it something that should stand out? Like, I don't know. What are your guys' thoughts on this? Is it, am I just wasting my curiosity?
Well, Noah means rest.
Right.
So he names him rest because this one will grant us rest, relief from the work, from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. And I think it seems in the flow of the text this is pointing ahead to the flood.
Right.
But it's a little bit vague as to, like, how is the flood granting us rest and relief? Other people have read this as referencing to how Noah plants a vineyard, that he has fruitful work as opposed to the painful toil, that planting a vineyard and learning how to farm is the way he fulfills this. But it doesn't, like we were saying before, it doesn't really make sense. Like, nobody else could farm before Noah. And they just were awful at it, and so it was painful toil, and then Noah figured out a couple farming tricks and started planting vineyards and stuff like that.
Fertilizer and changes the world.
And so he granted relief to humanity through that. I think it's more like the sense of it is, because this segues into the earth is totally wicked and God's going to wash it clean with a flood. I think the flood story seems to be, the problem is humanity and it's spreading evil, and he's granting relief not to humanity, but to the earth, who's being destroyed by humanity.
Mm.
And the relief that is given is the flood. It's cleansing and removing evil and starting fresh. And so I think it gets fulfilled in the flood.
Mm. Yeah, I even think that it provides relief. Getting sin and wicked people out of the way provides a certain relief to those who are following God. You know, if Lamech is from a godly line and his descendants, Noah is a godly person and Shem is a godly person, and certainly starting over in the post-flood world would have been a more pleasant environment than the wickedness that prevailed before the flood.
Yeah. Especially because this segues into the beginning of chapter 6 is talking about how wicked everything is.
Yeah.
And the context for the flood, and yet there's this one family. Yeah, so the relief is in the removal of evil. I think that makes sense. Yeah. What's interesting is, like, in the flow of Genesis here, just kind of picking up how the book's developing. Chapter 4 talks about Cain and Abel, and then outlines the descendants of Cain. So there's this lineage of Cain, the kind of the wicked Cainites.
Right.
And then chapter 5 talks about the descendants of Adam through Seth. And this is sort of like the godly remnant line, that the Sethites are sort of those who still fear the Lord. And it's through that line that we get to Noah and this recreation, this uncreation, recreation of the flood story. And so it's showing that humanity and life is spreading, but also evil is spreading with it, and that's leading to this problem of not decreasing but increasing wickedness. And there's even parallels, like the seventh from Adam in Cain's line is Lamech, the Cainite Lamech in chapter 4, who's really wicked. He's the first guy that takes two wives, which is interesting. And he brags about how, like, he murders this guy, and he kind of is bragging about it. And he's this, like, growing arrogance that he's worse than Cain.
Hmm.
The seventh from Adam in Seth's line is Enoch, who it says he walked with God. Where is it? Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. So you see these two parallel lines. And so the story's developing that way, and that leads us into the need for the flood through the wickedness.
So we have someone so wicked, on one hand, Lamech to Cain, that he's, you know, killing people and taking extra wives, and then we have someone so godly on the other side in the same order that doesn't experience death, and God just takes him up because
so
of his righteousness.
A multiplication of evil and a multiplication of things aren't spreading through addition.
Right.
It's multiplying in evil and
godliness.
But then by chapter 6, you're seeing such a spread of evil that the only one that is going to be spared is Noah and his family.
Right. Now, I mean, for five chapters into the Bible, I found that interesting because in the video of Genesis, I mean, part of this, I was talking to my wife about this, I hadn't paid a super close attention in, especially in Old Testament reading that I've done, of names. And just in the last couple of years, I started going, you know, names are really important, probably, because they're in there for a reason. Mm-hmm. Like, and their names are remembered. So I've made a concerted effort in my personal study to just pay more attention to names and try to draw connections. And I was like, this could be confusing in that the first five chapters of Genesis, we have two guys named Lamech.
And
one is like the father of Noah. And then in the video, they talk about the guy, like the, yeah. You know, I'm thinking of the visual in the Bible Project video of Lamech standing up on a mountain, barrel chested and raising his arms and declaring as evil. It can be a little confusing. So, these are the kinds of things that can stand out. One other thing that maybe we can touch on, and maybe we can touch on something else if we have some time, but, was chapter 9. So, the flood happens. The earth is wiped clean. The flood subsides. New life begins. Noah plants his vineyard, and then there's this kind of weird little story that happens that I think garners some discussion at least, because it's one of those stories that you could just read and go, huh, that's weird, and keep going. And then the more you pause and think about it, the more you kind of can consider other options maybe for it and go like, oh, this could be really terrible. And it's chapter 9, verse 20. So it says, Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth. I can't even read today. Yeah. Took a garment and laid it out, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall be he shall be to his brothers." And then it carries on. And then he blesses his sons, other sons. So there's this weird parable where Noah's a farmer, he's planted a vineyard, partakes of his crop in abundance, apparently, and gets a little sauced, passes out naked, apparently, it would read. And it very much at first reading looks like Ham walks in, sees his dad naked, and does something about it to his brothers. Tells him, and that's shameful that he saw his father naked, and then the other two brothers don't want to see. So this the question is this whole idea of what does his nakedness mean? Like, because the more you pull that thread, you could go, it could mean anything from assault to mockery to all these different areas. And so, like, why do you guys think this story is in the text? Why is it maybe important to think about?
I think why it's really important is because of this. We have these prophecies given here, right? Mm-hmm. God is we're given these curses on Canaan, and then the blessing on the God of Shem, and then on Japheth. So I think that's really why we have it in here, right? Because later in the story, yeah, we hear more about
who's those reading. Because JD, who's reading
this? Yeah, this is the people
wrote
of Israel
it down, and who's reading it, and when?
That's right.
That's one of the most important questions, because we're reading about Noah, but it's not. We're reading this. Moses is writing this down for the people of Israel as they're about to enter the promised land.
Into the land of Canaan. Yeah.
Filled with these Canaanites who are wicked, evil people. And so the question is not only when did it happen. The more important question is who wrote it and when and for who is the first audience. The first audience is the people coming out of exile, the generation out of those who came out of the Exodus, out of Egypt. It's their children who receive the Torah and take it into Canaan. So this is all about the Canaanites.
That's
why
right.
the story's there. Now, what does it mean?
This is the backstory to why this God telling us to move into the land of Canaan and wipe them out.
Uh-huh. And there's a connection between the sexual perversion of the Canaanites, which is well documented even historically, with the origin of Canaan, the son
of Ham.
Of Ham, and his father, Ham's sexual perversion that goes all the way back to here.
And so Ham is the first member of the nation of Canaan. He's the father of Canaan.
Well, his son's name is Canaan.
Yeah, his son is Canaan. Yeah.
And so they eventually become the Canaanites.
Right.
Is the Canaanites are the descendants of Canaan and Ham.
Hmm.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Egypt is a son of Ham as well.
Oh.
Mitzrayim is the Hebrew word for that.
Huh.
Yeah, it's a little area. It talks about, the sons of Ham. Kush is like Ethiopia,
right.
Egypt, right?
Yeah.
Put and Canaan. So it's kind of like all the bad guys that Israel deals with is the descendants of Ham.
And this leads to the kingdom of Babel. The beginning of in verse 10, chapter 20, right. 10. Under Shinar. Yeah. So, I mean, in some ways, the book of Genesis is setting up for us not only these events, but it's more about telling us about the people that are there now, like when they're reading it. So as the descendants of Israel are going into Canaan, they're learning the backstories of all their neighbors.
That's right.
And Genesis is more about that than it is about telling us about ancient events. Now, it is telling us about ancient events as well, but those ancient events are informing why the people of this nation and those descendants and these guys over here, why they act the way they do, they are the way they are. So it gives us the backstory of the Canaanites. When you get to Abraham, and we're talking about Isaac and Ishmael, and you get the backstory there, and all these. So you're getting the origin stories, not only of the earth, which is usually why we read Genesis, to read the origins of the earth. We're getting the origin stories of every people group of the Middle East for the time when Israel's going into Canaan.
Yeah, that
why they are a special people and the descendants of the promise, and not these people.
Interesting. It's not as explicit as that, as you just said it, but that makes a lot of sense.
They're getting the backstory of all their neighbors.
Yeah.
Now, so...
Yeah, what you were saying earlier about paying attention to names.
Yeah.
In the ancient world, the name was very important. Your name was all that you were.
Yeah.
You know, God says, I've exalted above all things my word and his name, you know.
Yeah.
So your name is so important, and later we are told all these people, like exactly what you're saying. I'll just give a few more examples. It talks about Sidon and you know, the Amorites and all these people. They're all listed there, and later in the Bible you constantly encounter who are these the Sidonians and
right.
So I think we do need to pay closer attention to the names because ancient people would have. And that's why they all included it for us.
Yeah, I mean, I found it because I think sometimes the natural thing to do when you're reading your scriptures is kind of go like, okay, this part's not important. This one's hand could like you just you kind of go like it's just listing names. It's kind of like when you skim it looking for things that stand out, things you recognize. But let's go back to this issue of nakedness for a second.
Yeah.
Like, because to me, as a, you guys have a lot more theological education than I do. This isn't a passage that I've spent any time really studying or whatever. But, it seems to me there has to be a lot more going on in this story than is written. It seems
an
like
accidental glance.
It seems like it's very much written from a perspective of politeness, almost, for lack of a better term, and that I can't imagine that God will curse, or Noah would curse his son for accidentally kind of walking in on him naked. Like, that's something that happens. I lived in a dorm, you know, sometimes you walk in a room and you're like, oh, oops, sorry, and I don't believe that deserves a cursing, right? To me, it seems like it's either something very perverse and sexual that he assaulted his father, or to that extent, or there was some sort of mockery and lack of reverence and respect for his father shown in his kind of voyeurism or deliberate kind of peeking in on him. And then you had pointed out something in Leviticus that kind of maybe plays into that, potentially.
I'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, I'm just thinking, in order to for us to evaluate the shameful act that is done here, we can't do it from our standards today. We have to think in terms of what would these people have considered a disgraceful act that then needs to be condemned and cursed. And then the other thing that I just want to say is that these cursings, these guys, like, oftentimes they say things that are more significant than the situation at hand. It's a prophetic element to the statement.
Right.
You know, like, he starts talking about Canaan, who's not, you know, and the descendants of Canaan. You know, it's Noah's prophetic here, speaking about things far in the future. So I don't think that Ham's act needs to necessarily merit the full weight of what Noah then says, you know.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Yeah, like, you see prophetic. This throughout the text. Like, in, you see Ishmael or Isaac acting, saying prophetic things. You see Jacob talking about the 12 sons of Israel. He just, they can say things that are far, it clearly seems like they're acting prophetically.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't necessarily it's not just a quick little reply to the situation at hand.
Yeah.
So I don't know, and I think that, I don't know if Ham assaulted his father, but to me, I think it's shame enough to, I mean, at this point, we've got to remember that Ham is over 100 years old. His father is 600, and he walks in on his father, does something that's disgraceful. His father knows about it, and then he's so arrogant as to come and call his brothers, and he wants them to join in this, and they then show the proper way to act towards their father. And of course, in the ancient cultures, your father is your lord. You need to respect him and treat him with dignity, and he just despised that completely.
Mm-hmm. So it could really be anything from just a pure lack of respect, and because we're talking, this would be honor shame kind of culture.
Yeah, we're not talking about like a glance.
No.
Right.
This is clearly something more. At minimum, he has seen his naked father in sort of a voyeuristic, maybe lustful or some perverse way.
So I think. Yeah.
And bragged about it, mocked his father, perhaps, shamed him, called others to celebrate the disgrace of his father. So that's like a minimum.
Yeah.
Is there more there? It doesn't say any more there. Yeah. The reason why you wonder is because in Leviticus 18, this phrase of your father's uncovering the nakedness of your father, or etc., there's this whole list of people you're not supposed to uncover the nakedness of.
Yeah.
Namely everyone. But it's like, there it almost sounds like a euphemism for something greater, for something sexual. You don't uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. You don't uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. You don't uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law, etc., etc.
Yeah, and this is in Leviticus. It's certainly sexual relations.
It's not just looking.
No.
Yeah.
It's a euphemism for adultery.
Right.
And these are all the people you don't have sex with, namely anyone who's like in the law. It's specifying not them. It's shameful for all these things. And so you wonder, reading that back in, is something more happen? But the text itself, I mean,
it doesn't sound
like that.
The key pieces of evidence for me, and I think JD pointed out too, is that no one knew what
happened. He wakes up and knew,
right?
So after.
So that this clearly was the thing that stood out to me. It can read at first glance very like an accident. And the more you look at it, you go, this was no accident. Like, this was an intentional sinister act of some kind, to some degree, by this son toward his father that the other two sons were unwilling to participate in and actually wanted to protect their father from.
And I think the focus is on dignity and shame and honor. Rather than
like sexual perversion or something.
I totally think so too, because why would he call his brothers?
Yeah.
Because the text does say he saw it, right? Like he looked, he saw it, and then he calls his brothers to come check it out or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's just, that is showing that the fact that he looked like that and then called someone else is a disgrace to his father. And the fact that Noah, who knows, maybe Noah's in a bad state there, he's lying there in his drunkenness and he can't help himself, and then his son comes in there and does whatever he does to him, whether it's all verbal or physical or whatever. It's just a terrible thing. I mean, especially in light of the ancient world, this is just disgrace, and this son would have to get kicked out of the family for this, and there'd be severe repercussions.
Right. So I think
so. It could be something like that. But I think part of the purpose of the story is to show how this sexual perversion,
that's right,
which originates with a voyeuristic looking and mocking, maybe calling others to join in, really multiplies into the descendants of Canaan and this sexually perverse culture.
Hmm.
And this phrase comes up again, uncovering the nakedness of your father and or others is leads to a more sexual act.
Yeah, because then it talks just later we hear all about Sodom and the perversions that go on there.
And those are descendants of
Ham. Exactly.
Yeah.
Man, it's. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, it's January 5th today. It's it's exciting. Like I enjoy this kind of stuff personally, but. I would say it's really easy to give up on like a Bible reading program when you're just trying to just get her done. Like just kind of read through it and did my reading for the day, I can move on to the next thing. But when you can give yourself just a little more time, and in reality, I'm talking like, I do this, I've been doing it at home after we put our little girl to bed, and it literally is like maybe 20 minutes. Half an hour.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm taking my time, and I feel like there's so much more that is getting uncovered through it than if I just kind of read through it in 5 minutes or 10 minutes just to kind of check it off the list.
Mm-hmm.
So if you haven't started, it's only January 5th, so you got some time to catch up. I think today's chapter 15 we're starting? 16
to 18.
16 to 18. So like, it's compelling. It's a compelling thing to do, and I think it's a really cool thing for a church to do together.
And I think just one thing I'd say, as you're reading, the question to ask yourself, if you come up to a puzzling section in Genesis or in any of the Pentateuch, I think that the question to ask is not, what does this mean? That's a good question too, but why is this story here, and what would it have said to the people of Israel entering the Promised Land?
Right.
Because that's the intended audience. It's not us. We're reading someone else's book.
Yeah.
What would this story have told the Israelites entering the Promised Land? Because then I think when you ask that question, you're getting to Moses' written, like, intended meaning.
Yeah.
And whenever you're at the author's intended meaning, you're at the part of what it really is getting at. So it's less about us and more about what would this have told the Israelites heading into the Promised Land.
Right.
So that's a good question to have in the back of your mind as you're reading through Genesis. Genesis is there to give a backstory to Israel and to all their neighbors.
Yeah, that helps us too with tolerate some of the mystery, some of the information that we are not given.
Yeah.
Perhaps the Israelites, they knew a lot more than we know today, so it might have made a little bit more sense to them.
Yeah.
They could ask Moses more about it if they wanted to, but that's great tip.
Understanding the Bible is really all about asking the right questions and not necessarily the questions we want answered.
Right.
When we ask the wrong questions, we end up kind of mutilating the text a bit. So asking the right questions, I think one of the right questions is why or what would this have said to the Israelites entering the Promised Land? Because then we're getting close to Moses' intended meaning, God's intended meaning.
Yeah, and if in your reading things come up and you're unclear as to what they mean, feel free to pull Steve and myself aside on a Sunday after church and ask them, and we can include them in the B-side or try to get you an answer. We won't promise that we'll give you an answer on the spot because we're reading it that day.
We need to ask JD.
Yeah, we need to ask JD. And also send questions about what you're reading on a regular basis. To the B-side at thchurch.ca, or other questions about how it relates to faith and culture and things that you're coming up with that you just want us to weigh in on. We can't promise that we're going to have all the answers.
When can we give away Star Wars spoilers? That's what I want to know. Like, it's been 3 weeks.
Yeah. Are we allowed to talk about that yet?
I have a strong opinion on it, and I've been holding off on it.
I haven't seen it yet, so I would prefer if you did.
Please go. Oh, you're not going
to. I'm not going to see it. That was like my ultimate like trump card. I'm like, guys, I haven't seen it yet. Like, we'll say that 6 years from now. I haven't seen any of them yet. So don't tell me what happens in any of the Star Wars. No, wait. I did see the one with Jar Jar Binks.
That's
the only one I saw. And apparently people say that that's
unfortunate. Doesn't count.
It was my brother's bachelor party in 1999. I remember it
clearly. Sounds like a real riot.
Yeah, my brother is kind of a nerd. He was one of those Star Wars people that liked it. Anyway. Well, a big thanks to JD for joining us. If you haven't met JD, he's a pretty cool cat. You know, I mean, him, his wife, Jalen, just joined our staff, yesterday. So she's on day two. She's helping out in the office, and it's great to have her. But, yeah, I'm sure JD will be back on the podcast because he's a lot more interesting than I am. We would love you to listen and send in your questions. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.